old age gathered together in one place. At home, everyone else was much younger, so he was naturally an exception, unique. But here, he felt himself absorbed into a compact, anonymous mass. Someone showed him to Yusufson's room. Yusufson was lying in bed with the covers pulled up to his chin.
"Ah, Westerberg, I'm so grateful that you haven't brought flowers. In any case, I'm not ill. Just bored stiff."
"The caretaker sends his greetings," said Uncle, looking for somewhere to sit. Both chairs in the room were piled high with books.
"Just put them on the floor," said Yusufson impatiently. "I'm tired of them. Nothing but words, all of them. They don't help. They're not enough."
After a pause, he continued, almost to himself,
"Westerberg, you don't understand what a great gift you've been given. Go on gazing at your blessed lotus blossoms. Go on looking at them, so long as there's time to look. And be grateful you've never felt any need to struggle towards an idea. I mean, search for something worth believing in and defending."
"Well, I did once defend a meadow," Uncle began. But Yusufson wasn't listening.
"In this place," said Yusufson, "time is just something that passes. It is no longer alive, any more than it is in those books. What I need is a clear picture, and I haven't much time. A clear picture of what I've wanted and tried to do, and what came of it all, and what really matters. It's important searching out something that might have real meaning, some sort of answer, an ultimate, valid conclusion. Do you know what I mean?"
"Not really. But in the end, does all that really matter, if all it does is upset you? And surely it's no more urgent now than it was before." Yusufson started to laugh.
"Westerberg, there's something very likeable about you. But you really are a great big donkey, aren't you?"
"Yes, of course," said Uncle. "But you will come back to the hothouse, won't you?"
"Oh, yes, 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 I'll come when I come. But for the moment, I shan't say another word. Not a single sensible word."
On his way home on the tram, Uncle didn't think much about what had been said in this undoubtedly very meaningful, if somewhat incomprehensible, conversation. "I must tell him about that meadow sometime," he thought. The year before Uncle met Yusufson, his relatives had hired a summer cottage on a skerry near the coast. The most characteristic feature of the island was a deep ravine cutting across it from west to east. The fishermen from whom they rented it had bridged the ravine with scrap wood so he wouldn't have to climb down to the meadow by the shore if he wanted to get from the dock to the cottage. The first time Uncle climbed the hill, he suddenly stopped abruptly. He'd caught sight of the meadow, which now, in July, was in full bloom, with the lightly and airily fluttering colours of all the different flowers. He could see that no one had crossed the meadow. It was as untouched as on that first morning in paradise, and he thought it even more beautiful than the hothouse. He decreed that no one should disturb the meadow. It was only to be seen. Every day, just before dawn, Uncle slithered down the hillside to sit in a corner of his meadow. It was at its most beautiful at the moment when the sun rose above the horizon. Then, just for a short time, the colours would glow with an almost unearthly translucency. What a sight! Uncle was not being unfaithful to the hothouse. It was just that what is constantly changing is superior to what is static. And the meadow was full of life. Sometimes he felt the same dangerous desire he experienced in the hothouse, as if his sense of wonder entitled him to walk right in and feel the meadow around him. But he held back. Then, one fine day, his relations decided to erect a tent sauna. Even the smallest cottage in Finland must have its sauna. Now, a tent sauna must be set up on level ground, and the only level ground on the island was Uncle's meadow. Some difficult days followed, with strong words and long silences. But, as so often happens in families, a compromise was reached. The sauna would be built under the bridge, very discreetly and with the least possible disturbance to the meadow. Once they had erected their sauna under the bridge and gone away, Uncle came to have a look. It was a square monstrosity with a metal chimney, a misshapen intrusion on the landscape. Inside, it was dim, with broad wooden planks for benches. A utilitarian, private place. Uncle sat down on the lowest bench. This caused the opening of the tent to frame his meadow, so that suddenly it resembled a painting. He almost felt he'd painted it himself. No one was surprised when Uncle said he would like to sleep in the sauna. They fixed it up for him and carried down every imaginable thing he might want. It was nice living under the bridge in between its strong supporting pillars. Then, one night at the end of July, the wind rose and high water swept through the ravine. He woke up to find himself on a wet mattress, not quite sure where he was. The tent fluttered and slapped, and it was too hot, as hot and damp as inside the hothouse, like a storm over the lily pond. Uncle waded out into the wet night, fascinated. Outside it was lighter. He could make out the glass cupola. It was much higher than usual, and the spiral staircase had vanished. The meadow billowed anxiously to and fro around him as he stumbled on. Yes, now at last he could embrace the meadow, walk straight into the lotus pond, feel soft elastic soil under his bare feet and the gentle touch of water lilies. And he could understand the hitherto unimaginable battle of innocent flowers against an aggressive sea. He was alone, free to possess what he loved, calm and untroubled. Gradually, he made his way up to the cottage and fell asleep. So he didn't see the tent sauna carried off at dawn. He didn't see the bridge bulge and break, the splintered wood tossed high and swept aside by the angry sea. A bit of the bridge caught fast in a crevice on the far side of the island and was chopped up for firewood. It would all be made useful one way or another. The family built a new bridge across the ravine. In Uncle's opinion, an eyesore. It wasn't a proper bridge, but looked more like a level crossing on a railway. The old bridge had been weathered by sun and salt water and had taken on the colours of the hillside. It had become a natural part of the structure of the island. But Uncle said nothing, because they were all so proud of the mess they had made. The meadow did not recover from the night of the storm, but he knew that next July it would be just as beautiful as before. And they'd done battle against the sea, he and the meadow together. One day, Uncle noticed their firewood was grey and full of nails, lumber from the old bridge. He chose some suitable pieces and found the tools he needed. Slowly, with great care, he began to make a tiny copy of the old bridge. When Uncle visited the hothouse after his visit to Peaceful Haven, Yusufson was back on his old perch. He put down his book and said, "Well, Vesterberg, your old hedonist, good to see you. As you see, I'm still searching for some sort of logic that makes sense." He made room on the bench and went on reading. Uncle sat down on his own side, the left. It was nice to have Yusufson back. Uncle thought about telling him about the meadow and the storm, but the time didn't seem right. So he just sat gazing at the beautiful lily pond. They continued coming to the hothouse, though not so often as before. The caretaker, who used to sit behind the bush with his crochet work, had retired. The new one, who didn't know them, would pass right in front of their bench with no sign of respect or recognition. Yusufson seemed perfectly happy to be left in silence, occasionally exchanging the odd word, underlining a sentence in his book. Every time Uncle let the silence stretch out, he grew more uneasy and annoyed. He'd begun to bring the model bridge with him, but it became harder and harder to show it and tell the story of the storm. He simply couldn't do it. The night when he embraced the meadow was slipping away from him. and Yusufson was no help at all. Then one day, as they were sitting as usual, a furious thunderstorm blew in over the city. A heavy squall threw open the hothouse doors. There was a crash of glass, and the storm burst in, making waves in the lily pond. Tiny waves, but waves nonetheless. Uncle stood up, walked forward, and waded straight into the pool, shoving aside leaves and lilies regardless, then turned and called out, "Yusufson, do you see what I'm doing?"
"Too good," said Yusufson, putting down his book. "Keep going. Very stimulating."
Later, they sat together till closing time. The storm had gradually subsided, and the caretaker calmed down too. Uncle talked about the meadow, and talked very well. Yusufson was a better listener than he could have expected. Uncle showed him the little bridge. He looked at Uncle and said,
"Yes, yes, I understand. The essence of the meadow. See, admire, experience, all that. And the bridge. What's the point of a bridge that doesn't lead anywhere?"
"Well, it doesn't mean anything," said Uncle angrily. "A bridge is a bridge. It's a bridge. Just a bridge." "Here you are again trying to find meaning in something that's just obvious in itself. Where it goes and where it comes from doesn't matter. You just go over it, and that's all there is to it." The caretaker came over and suggested that Uncle go home before he caught cold. "We're having a conversation," said Uncle. "Yusufson, have you reached any conclusion? Have you found anything important in those books?"
"Oh, this and that," said Yusufson, smiling. "It takes time, but I always knew it would. It looks as if neither of us will ever convince the other. But do we need to?"
"No," said Uncle. "The other person only needs to listen and understand."
"I can accept that," said Yusufson. "I like that part about the meadow."
Uncle said, "Yes, I do think I told it rather well." They stood up together and went out through the hothouse's storm-shattered doors, and after a friendly word, separated, and each made his own way home.
Andrew Sachs was reading The Hot House by Tuva Jansson. The story was translated by Sylvester Mazzarella and abridged and produced by Gemma Jenkins. And back in the Royal Albert Hall for the third part of this evening's Prom, live here on BBC Radio 3, we're about to enjoy the fruits of a Finnish struggle for composer Jean Sibelius, his Symphony No. 5, commissioned by the Finnish government in honour of Sibelius's 50th birthday. And he conducted the first performance himself on that very occasion, the 8th of December 1915. But he wasn't completely happy with it, and over the next 4 years he revised it, and it was performed in two further versions, ending up with the Fifth Symphony as we know it today. "I wish to give my symphony another more human form," he said, "more down-to-earth, more vivid." The Danish National Symphony Orchestra's conductor Thomas Dausgaard chose the Sibelius for this programme of associations, as he calls it, as it was being completed and then rewritten at exactly the same time as the centrepiece of the Prom, Ruth Langor's The Music of the Spheres. But does Thomas Dausgaard find they have anything in common?
"I think what I experienced performing the Langard piece is that in spite of this being in distinct tableaus, separate pictures, there is a kind of undercurrent which is very strong. There is a tension going through from beginning to end, which, although it is in a completely different way from the Sibelius, somehow resembles the inner power of the Sibelius. In the Sibelius, we find it's, in a way, more obvious. It's a more obvious pull going through to the end. But somehow I found in performance that there is a similar strength within them, which takes us right through to the last note. Apart from that, it's all much more organic the way it unfolds in Sibelius. I also think that there's a strong element in Sibelius' music which has to do with timelessness, or the longing for timelessness. And in that way, I think, though they approach it very differently, I think they have something very strong in common. And I think it must have something to do with what many of us long for, being one with nature, forgetting about time, being very much in the moment. And you know from descriptions of Sibelius' joy of nature that he could really get quite ecstatic about what he experienced, whether it was a snowflake or birds crossing the sky. So there's something about this awe for nature and this longing for being one with nature, which I think goes through the music we play tonight.
Thomas Dalsgaard. And by the time of the Fifth Symphony, Sibelius was comparing the process of composition to the rearrangement of thematic ideas. It's as if God had thrown down the tiles of a mosaic from heaven's floor and asked me to determine what kind of picture it was. And in the case of the Fifth, Sibelius didn't find the right pattern until he'd gone through those 4 years of revision and three separate versions. Yet it feels so well integrated, so thought through, it's hard to believe that it's all the result of shuffling his stack of compositional tiles. The end result is a compact three-movement structure with a particularly inventive first movement which grows from the opening horn call and accelerates to its exhilarating conclusion. And here to conduct the Danish National Symphony Orchestra in Sibelius' Symphony No. 5 is the orchestra's principal conductor and deviser of this evening's prom, Thomas Dalsgaard.
Thank you.
the rugged, exultant ending of Sibelius's Symphony No. 5 in E-flat. Played for us at this evening's prom by the Danish National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Thomas Dausgaard. And it's one of the world's oldest radio orchestras, formed when the Danish Broadcasting Corporation was launched in 1925. Thomas Dausgaard charging back into the middle of the orchestra to give all the winds their moment of glory, their time in the spotlight, and the four horn players of the Danish National Symphony Orchestra. The rest of the brass following them to their feet to cheers from the promenaders. Well, the orchestra's manager was telling me it began basically as a chamber group for broadcasts only, no public concerts, and just grew from there. And these days, there's a core of 99 musicians. It's based in its glamorous new concert hall in Copenhagen, opened just last year, designed by French architect Jean Nouvel. If you see pictures of it, it's a kind of beautiful blue-screened translucent box containing the main concert hall, suspended, I was told earlier, like a meteorite from space. And Christina Ostrand, the orchestra's leader, was telling me how their sound's changed and continues to evolve since they've moved into the new hall. Now she says they can really hear each other and there's really no hiding place, so it's exciting and also a little frightening at the same time. And they can also see each other much better thanks to the way they're seated, she said, as in a Greek amphitheatre with the audience all around them. Here comes Thomas Dausgaard once again, bowing to the promenaders. I think there'll be an encore. A little more Sibelius, Ariel's song from his Music for the Tempest. A nice gesture from the Danes, combining Nordic music with a reference to British culture and Shakespeare. But what next? The Danish National Symphony Orchestra gets a break. Thomas Dausgaard's off to rehearse with his other ensemble, the Swedish Chamber Orchestra, before he takes them round the festival circuit and brings them to the proms on the 23rd of August for some Schumann and Berlioz. If you've enjoyed this programme, it's something they tried at home at the weekend, an open rehearsal with an invited audience. And more music, stand by. Corks popping from within the percussion section there. That was the Champagne Gallop by Hans Christian Lumbu, the man they call the Strauss of the North, composer of waltzes, polkas and gallops. Although I gather if you're Danish, Johann Strauss the Younger is the Lumbu of the South. The Danish National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Thomas Dausgaard, a rousing finale to their prom this evening. Tomorrow's prom offers a Berlioz overture, Chopin's second piano concerto with Nelson Freire, Roussel's Third Symphony, and Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra and young French conductor Lionel Brangier. But as the Danes head home with the applause of the promenaders ringing in their ears and the music of the Spheres and Sibelius's Call of the Wild still ringing in ours, back in Broadcasting House, here's John Shea.
Andrew, thank you very much. Andrew McGregor presented tonight's live prom from the Royal Albert Hall. As ever, there's another chance to hear it via the iPlayer for the next 7 days, or again here on BBC Radio 3 next Monday afternoon from 2 o'clock. And if in the meantime you're tempted to submit your own online review of the concert, you can do that via the proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms, and then click on share. And I should also tell you that Sibelius's Fifth Symphony will be the subject of Discovering Music next Sunday afternoon on BBC Radio 3, beginning at 5 o'clock. Well, back to this Wednesday evening. The essay in 45 minutes continues our series looking back at the dramatic events of 1989 in Eastern Europe. The world turned upside down. That's at 11 o'clock. But before that, with the time at just after 10:15, another chance to hear one of our features broadcast earlier in the year. The first permanent English settlement in Canada was established 400 years ago at Cupid's Cove. Sean Street now visits Newfoundland to explore how recent archaeological discoveries and centuries-old historical documents are together revealing its history.
We just walked along the beach, examining the eroding banks, looking for evidence of a 17th century occupation. And this is a pipe stem with quite a large bore, probably a 7 or 8 bore in it. And that suggests a date range of 1680 or before, you know, some probably mid-17th century pipe stem.
Yeah, this is a pipe stem. Just
literally, just found.
Just come out the ground.
Just as we were just talking. A hot July Sunday on the east coast of Newfoundland. At Cupid's Cove, once called Cooper's Cove, the head of a long, narrow inlet with just a few houses dotted along the rocky shore. Archaeologist William Gilbert is leading his team in a dig that links the old and new worlds of Europe and North America.
Even something as simple as that tells us that there were people here in the first half of the 17th century, and I guess they were smoking as well. They were having a smoke while they were here.
Did find some coarse earthenware, some bellows flint. Somebody brought it over from England.
Because it isn't native to these
shores. No. It's native to England, so it was brought over.
We're here at the site of the Cooper's Cove Plantation, which is the oldest English settlement in Canada. It was established in 1610 by a consortium of London and Bristol merchants, the London and Bristol Company of Merchant Venturers. And the first governor of this plantation site, this colony, was a Bristol merchant by the name of John Guy. And in August of 1610, John Guy and 39 colonists arrived here and began the work of building the Cooper's Cove Plantation site.
Right Worshipful, it may please you to understand that we arrived, God be praised, all in safety in the Bay of Conception, in Newfoundland, in the harbour here called Cooper's Cove. This harbour is 3 leagues distance from Collier's Bay to the northeastward, and is preferred by me to begin our plantation, for the goodness of the harbour, the fruitfulness of the soil, the largeness of the trees, and many other reasons.
We came here first in 1995, myself and my crew from the Backlew Trail Heritage Corporation, to see if we could find where within Cupid's the Cooper's Cove Plantation once stood. Before we came in and started digging holes in the ground, which is what archaeologists generally like to do, I went back to the original documents to see if I could find any evidence that would help to narrow down the location of the site. And we're really lucky in that we have a number of documents that have survived from the early days of the plantation site. There was nowhere in those documents that said the plantation is in such and such a place. But there were 3 clues in the documents that helped narrow down the location. Guy mentions that the plantation was 12 score from the lake, which is Cupid's Pond up here on the back of the hill behind the harbor. And a score is a distance of 20 paces, so 12 times 20. We knew it was 240 paces from the lake. John Guy and another colonist, Henry Kraut, both mentioned that the plantation was next to a stream, and there used to be a stream that flowed just a little bit west of here. It's since been diverted. And Henry Kraut mentions in his diary that the plantation was on the landward side of the little saltwater pond here at the bottom of the harbor. So those were our three clues initially.
The English had been interested in Newfoundland since the time of Cabot. That's the end of the 15th century. So he makes a couple of voyages. And there are, in fact, some English fishing voyages in the early 16th century, sometimes in cooperation with Azorean Portuguese captains.
Peter Pope lectures in anthropology and history at Memorial University in St. John's, Newfoundland, and he's the author of Fish into Wine, a key text exploring the way of life that developed on the island in the 17th century.
By the end of the 16th century, I'm saying by, say, the 1580s, the 1590s, England's asserting itself. It's competing with Spain and with Portugal, which is part of Spain at that time, and there's increasingly cries that Newfoundland should be settled. There's a number of tracts that are published at the end of the 16th century, Anthony Parkhurst, Richard Whitburn, and so on.
The country of Newfoundland, as it is here truly described, is little inferior to any other for the commodities thereof, and lies, as it were, with open arms towards England, offering itself to be embraced and inhabited by us.
It's in that context that the London-Bristol Company funds the settlement at Cupid's. So Cupid's is a kind of a crucial step. It's the first formal colonization of Newfoundland. The settlement there survived. That is clearly the route of further settlement in Conception Bay, which by the end of the century is the most heavily settled and the richest part of Newfoundland.
We're really lucky. We have 17 letters that were written from here back to England between 1610 and 1613. And we also have Henry Kraut's diary. Henry Kraut was a colonist who arrived here first in 1612. He was from southwest Devon, somewhere around Plymouth. And he kept a diary from the 1st of September 1612 till the 13th of May 1613. In that diary, he makes a number of references to the saltwater pond. And at one point, he mentions that the saltwater pond froze over last night.
February the 10th, 1613. This morning, the little pond between the house and the brew house, and also the harbour, was all taken over with a cream of ice. This night, the wind was at west-northwest. Little wind, but freezing hard all the night.
As a result of that, we know the brew house was on the other side of the saltwater pond. And he also mentions that there was a stage before the brew house. So we know there was a stage in front of it as well.
So it all helps to build a real picture.
Yes, to bring it all together. Yeah. That's a lot of what we've been doing over the past 15 years is trying to match up the documentary evidence with the archaeological evidence, the stuff that's coming out of the ground, you know. John Guy did produce a map of the plantation, but it hasn't survived, or if it has survived, we haven't found it. So what we're doing is mapping 17th century Cooper's Cove ourselves in the 21st century.
It's not the model of colonization that would typify the British Empire, say, in the 19th century or even the 18th century, the colonization of Australia. No, it's a different kind of thing.
The thinking that drove the Cupid's colonization was highly practical. Peter Pope is keen to draw a distinction between British imperialist ambition and a transatlantic mercantile impulse.
It's a business. It's this North Atlantic fish trade where Europeans come to Newfoundland in the summer. They salt and dry fish. Basically, it's an inshore fishery. There are properties on the shore, facilities constructed for processing the fish.
The first reference that we have to a load of salt fish arriving back in Europe, or at least arriving back in England, is from 1502. John Amain aboard the Gabriel sails into Bristol with a load of salt fish from Newfoundland. And there were people fishing here before that, we know that for sure.
The idea of salting fish, which is so fundamental to the history of Newfoundland's economy, is something that actually still does go on. And with me is Ray Hoskins from New Harbour. And Ray, you still do this. Could you give me a quick masterclass in the procedure?
Okay. Well, first of all, he goes out and catches the cat. We got some. Takes the heads of them, and then we split some down through the middle, takes out what he calls the sand bone in the codfish, and just lays them out flat, puts them in salt over a period of 5 or 6 days, take it out of salt, just washes it out, and just puts it on the flake.
Well, a fish flake is a rudimentary wooden platform, usually with boughs over it, used for drying the fish. It's one of the oldest European architectural features in the New World.
And good windy days, that's the best time for drying the fish. Two or three good days on it, that's how he dries the fish.
When Guy arrived, this would have been a very busy place in the summertime. Up to 5,000 English fishermen here, 10,000 French, plus Spanish and Portuguese as well. So seasonally, this would have been a very busy place. The migratory fishery ran from May till September, late August, early September, and the rest of the year, it would have been a wilderness, basically. When Guy arrived, there was a transition from the migratory fishery to the beginning of permanent settlement.
As Bill Gilbert makes very clear, this was already a major industry. In fact, salted cod from Newfoundland can lay claim to being the very first commodified processed food. No wonder John Guy was so keen to point out to his masters in England the real value of Cupid's Cove.
Here is a good beach, and the fishing near. To be assured of a good place to fish and a beach, boats and stage may be worth more than £100 or £200 yearly, which the company may be assured of by the plantation, because they shall be sure to be the first here every year to take what stage they shall have need of for their own use.
And that means that there's a certain value to having some kind of permanent staff to take care of that, to watch over those things in the winter. Partly to watch over them so that you can have the same fishing room next year. Otherwise, it's first come, first served. And partially because of a pressure created by the Beothuk, the native people of Newfoundland, who were quite interested in European fishing sites because, hey, there's all these nails there. And, you know, all you have to do is burn a boat or a fishing stage, and you can take the nails and turn them into handy tools. So there was a certain advantage to having some people overwintering. But the roots of the thing were definitely commercial. They were in the interests of that great big industry, the fish trade, which I always say it's one of the extinct dinosaurs of economic history. It's this huge thing that once existed that we've completely forgotten.
If you went any farther east from here, you're no longer near the stream and you're no longer on the landward side of the saltwater pond. So this was the only place left, really. We walked up onto the edge of the terrace here, and there'd been a big windstorm the winter before and a number of trees had blown over. And when we started to look in the dirt that was thrown up from where the trees blew over, we started finding 17th century pottery, 17th century bottle glass. So we knew we were on the edge of a 17th century site. And really, based on what the document said, it was the only place left, you know, that where it might possibly have been. So what we did is we got permission from the landowners, and we've standard archaeological survey procedure. We ran lines east, west, north, south, and we dug holes at regular intervals along those lines. And when we did that, we found that we had an area that was about 95 feet by 170 feet within which there was 17th century material. That in itself was significant because John Guy mentions that when he came here, he enclosed an area that was 90 feet by 120 feet, and he built his first dwelling house and storehouse inside that enclosure. So, looked very positive.
From the 6th of October until the 16th of May, our company had been employed in making of a storehouse to hold our provisions and a dwelling house for our habitation, which was finished about the 1st of December, with a square enclosure of 120 foot long and 90 foot broad and a workhouse to work dry in and to make boats or any other work out of the rain.
The more work we did, the more digging we did, just everything just seemed to come together. So there can be no other interpretation as to what this is other than that it is the original plantation site from 1610. First English settlement in Canada.
Right next to the plantation site, the dig here in Cupids, is the trailer, which is a sort of weekend and summer home of Ruth Baker. She very kindly let me come into your trailer, Ruth. And Bill has found the site here. Did it surprise you that it was right on your doorstep here?
Thought it probably was up in this part of the community, because it's a logical spot where you could just sit here and look out the harbour and see all the pirates that would come in or any boats or whatever. And of course, I've been here from day one when Bill asked us for permission to do the test pit on our garden, because we had a potato garden there. So it was really exciting. I mean, he found a few artifacts, some pipes, and we also, of course, found a cannonball and some pottery in our garden when we'd ploughed the garden for our potatoes, right? And then, of course, Bill came and everything started to unfold from there.
Right here in the middle of the display case here, you see this little silver coin. It looks quite humble, but it's actually the oldest English coin ever found in Canada.
Down the road from the dig itself is the Cupid's Museum and Project Laboratory, where more than 139,000 artefacts recovered from the site are being conserved, catalogued and stored.
It's an Elizabethan silver fourpence that was minted in the Tower of London sometime between December of 1560 and October of 1561. Obviously, it's very worn. It was in circulation for quite a long time and must have fallen out of the purse of one of the early colonists who came over here from England in 1610 or 1611, who must have been really upset when they lost it because this was worth half a day's wages or more.
This part of the dig we've come to now, Bill, is an example of how the documentation can inform questions that might arise when you come to something that you don't quite understand. Mm-hmm. Because what we're looking at here, on the face of it, is a small declivity in the ground. It doesn't appear to convey very much at all.
Yeah, it was a puzzle for me for a number of years, actually. It's a shallow pit that was dug in the ground. When we dug it, it was clear to us that it had been dug very early in the occupation and filled in shortly after it was dug. It wasn't open very long. And I was puzzling over this for a long time. You know, why would they have dug this shallow pit and then filled it back in again? And then I went back to John Guy's first letter that he wrote on the 6th of October, 1610, in which he mentions that at that point they were just starting to work on the dwelling house. Now, the dwelling house was finished by the 1st of December, 1610. But he says that we have made safe places to shroud us in until our dwelling house is finished. And it just sort of, a light bulb went off. And I said, well, this is probably what this is. This is one of those safe places. So it's a temporary pit house. They dug down a couple of feet. They piled the earth up on the sides of it, improvised some sort of roof, maybe a sail to shroud them in. And then when the dwelling house was finished, the 1st of December, 1610, they pushed it all back in. So this is probably the very first building that was constructed here on the plantation, and I guess one of the first structures in Canada, in North America, really.
Everybody knew about John Guy. My mother always used to say, they've seen John Guy, it must have been his ghost or whatever, up there on the bridge with, he had his white gloves on and clapping his hands, so it might have been the trees creaking, but it was always said that, right? And I grew up believing that and thinking that, right?
So the spirit of John Guy. The
spirit of John Guy was still alive, in other words, yeah.
We do know that the first English child in Canada was born here at the Cooper's Cove Colony. We don't know the name of the mother, but the father was Nicholas Guy, who was probably one of John Guy's cousins. It was a lusty boy who was born on the 27th of March, 1613. We also know that that Nicholas and his family moved from here to Carbonear. And the Guy family established themselves in Carbonear as one of the most important planter families, settler families, on the whole English shore. And you can trace the family right through.
At the farthest extent up the hill of the site, we've come to actually a very poignant place, because not only do we have the first English dwelling house in North America on this site, we have here the first cemetery, the first graveyard of people who died, often in the very early years of the settlement here.
We, having been now more than 10 months upon this voyage of 39 persons, which was all our number which wintered here, there are wanting only 4.
It was really a fluke that we found this cemetery here. We knew that there had to be one here somewhere, but it was the 15th of November 2007, and it was really the last good day we had before the snow came that year. The snow came early that year. So we decided to come up on the site and do a bit of cleaning up. And there was a mesh gate that was half buried in the ground. I was going to leave the gate there, but one of the crew members, Linda Saunders, decided she wanted to lift it up. So she grabbed a hold of it. I grabbed a hold of it. We pulled it up. And in under that gate, there was a headstone.
And that's the headstone we have?
The headstone right there, yeah. And we now know that it's made from Portland stone, from the area around Portlandville and Dorset. It's probably an early 18th century stone. And there is an inscription on it, but we haven't been able to decipher it yet. So we opened up the area, and there was a grave associated with the stone. And we also found another 8 graves in the same area. So we have a cemetery here now of 9 graves altogether. And I think chances are very good that this is the original cemetery from 1610. The first person to be buried here was Thomas Piercy, and he died on the 11th of December, 1610. And according to John Guy, who recorded this in his second letter that he wrote in May of 1611, Thomas Percy died of thought.
One Thomas Percy, a sawyer, died the 11th day of December of thought, having slain a man in Rochester, which was the cause, being unknown unto me until a day before he died, that he came on this voyage.
I guess John Guy assumed he died of a guilty conscience. Yeah.
To die of thought.
To die of thought, yes.
And one other, called John Morris, a tiler, miscarried the 1st of February by reason of a bruise. The third, called Marmaduke Whittington, was never perfectly well after he had the smallpox, which he brought out of Bristol with him, and died the 15th of February. And the fourth, called Thomas Stone, having at the first only a stiffness in one of his knees, kept to his bed 10 weeks, and would never stir his body, which lazinesses brought him to his end.
Right now we're in the community of Dildo in Trinity Bay, and we're aboard the Irish Mist, and we're going to sail out the arm, and we're going to retrace a bit of the route that John Guy followed when he sailed into Trinity Bay in October 1612. Dildo Arm here, this spot right here where we are now, is the place that Guy called Savage Bay. And he called it Savage Bay because this is the first place that he saw evidence of the native people, the Beothuk people. And a little farther down, if we have a chance, we'll go right down into the bottom of the bay to a place that he called Savage Harbor.
Here we found some savage housen, a halbert, a wooden target, and small coffins made of the bark of trees, and a broad way leading from the seaside through the woods.
The first attempt to contact the Beothuks, or at least the first that we were aware of, was in September of 1612, when they actually cut a trail from Cupid's overland about 22 miles from Conception Bay to Trinity Bay to Hopal, where we're going now, Mount Eagle Bay.
This morning departed 8 of our people again for Trinity Bay to find it by land. We found very fair birch trees passing through the woods and 4 places of open ground and passed 3 fresh water lakes with diverse beavers' nests in them.
They cut that trail specifically to try to make contact with the Beothuk people who were living here in Trinity Bay. And then about a month later, they left on their voyage and sailed into Trinity Bay and actually did meet and trade with the Beothuks and shared a meal with them on the beach about 20 miles north of here.
2 canoes appeared, and one man alone coming towards us with a flag in his hand of a wolfskin, shaking it and making a loud noise, which we took to be for a parley.
In the distance, you can see them in the canoe waving the white wolfskin.
Here on the wall of the museum is a 17th century illustration, which is I think during the anniversary year going to become quite iconic and very familiar to a lot of people.
In the United States, this image was usually identified as being a depiction of Bartholomew Gosnell trading with native people at Martha's Vineyard in New England in 1602. Those of us in Newfoundland who were familiar with the narrative of John Guy's voyage recognized immediately what it was. It's a depiction of Guy's encounter with the Beothuk on the 6th of November, 1612. But it's only in the last really year or so that historians and archaeologists in the United States have come to recognize that that is what it is. And it's as a result of some research that I did a few years ago. I went back to the original document to see what context it actually was published in. And it was originally published in German in 1628. And when you actually look at the German text that was published with this image, it's actually a German translation of John Guy's narrative of the voyage into Trinity Bay and the meeting with the Beothuk.
The shallop landed Master Whittington with the flag of truce, who went towards them. And coming towards Master Whittington, the savage made a loud speech and shaked the skin, which was answered by Master Whittington in like manner. And as the savage drew near, he threw down the white skin into the ground. The like was done by Master Whittington.
And in the foreground, you can see the white wolfskin at Master Whittington's feet.
Whereupon both the savages passed over a little water stream towards Master Whittington, dancing, leaping, and singing.
So there is a whole narrative here. In the foreground, an Englishman, Master Whittington, who was the first to come ashore, and two Native American people. He was approached by two Beothuk.
And coming together, the foremost of them presented unto him a chain of leather full of small periwinkle shells, a splitting knife, and a feather that stuck in his hair.
And you can see the feather right there in his hand.
The other gave him an arrow without a head.
An arrow without a head, which I guess is a symbol of peace. He presented the Beothuk with, you can see here, a knife, a hat, and a towel.
The former was requited with a linen cap and a hand towel, and he put presently the linen cap upon his head. To the other he gave a knife. And after, hand in hand, they all three did sing and dance.
This is a really extraordinary sight because we're under a cliff, almost right underneath a bald eagle that's looking down at us from the top of the cliff under its nest. Bill, birds of prey and their value was something that was linked very closely to the Guy settlement and a way of trading back to the old country, as it were.
Yes. Hawks in the old world were a highly valued commodity. And one of the things that our old friend Henry Crowd again was doing is he was acquiring hawks to send back to England to be sold and to be used in falconry. He mentions in 1612 that he had acquired two Torbay hawks that he sent back to England in August of 1612, along with a bear, actually, a young bear that he'd acquired as well from a fisherman. And he mentions as well that John Slaney, who was the secretary for the company, had encouraged him to acquire some more hawks to send back to James I. And he said, it would be much to my credit were I to do this.
These were very, very prestigious creatures.
Yeah. And there's one right up on the rock.
Staring down at us right
there. Yeah, yeah.
Bill, we've come ashore on Dildo Island, which is one of the sites that the letters led you to.
Yes, yes. And one of the things that brought us here, again, was Henry Crout. Henry had been with John Guy in 1612 when they sailed into Trinity Bay and met the Beothuks the first time. And in July of 1613, Henry and four other men came back from Cupid's, back into Trinity Bay in a chaloup, specifically to see if they could contact the Beothuk again. And Henry describes in that letter that on the 2nd of July, 1613, they had been moored a few miles to the west of here in Savage Bay. And as they were on their way in, they passed an island, which we now know is this island, Dildo Island.
We first espied a canoe hard upon the rocks, and presently we espied a savage's tilt, which made us to put ashore at the island. Coming ashore, we perceived the savages were newly gone from their house into the woods, for we found the stones to be warm in the midst of their house, which they had made their fire upon. In the end, we went into the house, which was covered with some skins, but by all imagination there could not be but a man, his wife, and child in the house, as it may appear by shoes and other things. So, having fully perused their house, and sundry roast meats upon their wooden spits, we left in their house both biscuit and cheese, one linen cape, and one napkin. And so we departed, without meddling with anything.
We wanted to see if we could find that Indian camp.
What did you find?
A great deal of evidence of Aboriginal occupation, extending back perhaps as far back as about 800 BC. That's a combination of Eskimo, Paleo-Eskimo people, and Indian people as well. Henry Crout opens this little window for us in his documents, so we can actually look in the 2nd of July, 1613. Okay, this is what was going on, you know.
In this place.
In this place, yeah.
Next day, we returned. And in the morning came unto the island where we found the savages' house the day before. But at our return, they and their canoe and provisions were gone, except some spits of their roast meat they left behind them, which I do think they left for us.
Last year, at the last week of our survey, we found an Indian fireplace. Right next to the fireplace, we found a small blue trade bead. So it may well be that this is the camp that Henry Crout saw on the 2nd of July, 1613.
I can't get over the implications of one bead being found.
A very small bead, a seed bead, yeah.
A tiny bead.
Yeah. What you're seeing in this situation is, you trace it really back to the beginning of mankind, when people came out of Africa, and one branch of the human family moved east across Asia and finally into the Americas. The other family moved west across Western Europe and into Britain. And in the 16th, 17th century, you get these two different branches of the human family coming together again, you know, across the Atlantic. It's very evocative, isn't it, really? Yeah.
Very, very poignant.
Yeah. We actually have found in Cupids, we found over 600 glass trade beads brought over specifically for that purpose to be traded with the Beothuk. But it seems that after 1620, the Beothuk began to withdraw from contact with Europeans. Initially, that may have been a wise move, because one of the things that really decimated a lot of native populations was European diseases. But in the long run, it proved fatal, because as Europeans began to settle along the coast, and eventually the whole, you know, coastline of Newfoundland was settled by people from the West Country and from Ireland, they lived in the interior in the winters, but spent about 7 or 8 months of the year on the coast, after seals, after salmon, after capelin, after all the, you know, rich resources on the coast. And when that supply was cut off, they couldn't survive in the interior. There was starvation, and sadly, by the second or third decade of the 19th century, there are no more Beothuk people. The Beothuk people are extinct today.
I've come back to the site of the dig with Bill Gilbert. On reflection, Bill, looking at the massive remains of the wall that you have here, that you've uncovered, it's facing the harbour.
They were uncertain, I guess, about the Beothuk people, but they were more concerned about their fellow Europeans as far as danger was concerned. We do know that in 1612, the activities of pirates, and specifically the pirate Peter Easton, posed a real danger to the colony, and they fortified the plantation.
We have been much hindered all this summer by Captain Easton, who hath done great harm to many poor fishermen in taking their victuals, ordnance, and men. This hath been the cause that none of us could follow our business.
We even had some of Sir Walter Raleigh's men on their way back from the Ghanaian voyage who attacked Bay de Verte to the north of here. They turned pirate and started attacking settlements here in Newfoundland. And Trinity Harbour as well. They attacked Trinity Harbour as well in 1619.
Notwithstanding the threat of piracy and uncertain times in Europe, Peter Pope points out that the impetus was to move out from the bridgehead of Cupid's Cove to expand the mercantile empire along the east coast of Newfoundland.
Well, there seems to have been a deliberate attempt by the company to set up a second settlement, which they called Bristol's Hope. I think it's very likely to have been Harbour Grace. It's pretty clear that some of the colonists moved out to other parts of Conception Bay. So there's certain names. Guy, for example, is still a surname from Conception Bay.
Bill and I have come about 25 miles north of Cupid's to Harbour Grace, and where we are now actually is in the middle of a thriving shipyard. They're tarring the bottom of some pretty sizable fishing boats over to our left here, and the smell is very pungent and very potent. Bill, this is really the next chapter in the story of the colonisation. What was it that motivated that chapter and the move to Harbour Grace?
The Bristol people had most of the expertise in the fishery, and they didn't feel that the London merchants were putting enough money into the colonizing effort. So they decided that they were going to leave Cupid's, leave Cooper's Cove, and come to this place where we are, Harbour Grace, and set up a second colony, which they called the Bristol's Hope Colony. And we know the colony was established by at least 1617. There's some documentary evidence to suggest the first colonists moved here from Cupid's about 1615, actually. And this place has been occupied continuously ever since. It's the second oldest English settlement in Canada. And Cooper's Cove never did grow into the major center that the merchants hoped it would. It remained a small place, probably two or three families living there. But this place really, really took off and was a major center from the 17th century right up through into the 19th century. Harbour Grace was almost on par with St. John's for a long time as a center for the fishery, the cod fishery, the seal fishery.
And it was here that we have another first in our story, really.
Yeah,
the first
yeah,
book of
yeah.
poetry written in Newfoundland by an Englishman.
the first book of poetry probably written in North America by an Englishman, actually. Robert Heyman, who was the governor of the colony. And during his stay here, he composed a book of verses, which, Sean, you've had a chance to have a look at some of those verses.
Yes, I have. Yeah. And in fact, there's one here to the first planters of the newfound land, which presumably is him being critical of what had happened subsequently at Cupid's as a result of the London merchant.
Seems that way, yes.
Let's have a... He says this. What aim you at in your plantation? Sought you the honour of our nation? Or did you hope to raise your own renown? Or else to add a kingdom to a crown? Or Christ's true doctrine for to propagate? Or draw salvages to a blessed state? Or our or people kingdom to relieve? Or show poor men where they may richly live? Or poor men's children godly to maintain? Or aimed you at your own sweet private gain? All these you had achieved before this day, and all these you have balked by your delay.
It seems like a dig at the London merchants, doesn't it? That they started this venture, but then they didn't follow through with the funding to properly finance it and ensure that it was a success. Whereas Heyman, being a West Countryman, the Bristol merchants and the West Country merchants were much more successful because they put a lot more into the plantation. And that's obvious even here today.